Welcome to the podcast, Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, your host, and our focus is on mastering communication as an essential leadership skill so you can command the room, connect with the audience, and close the deal in any context. After over 200 episodes, thanks to you, we are a top 1% podcast globally. So if you love listening to these conversations as much as I love sharing them with you, please take 30 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or just go to the website ratethispodcast.com/influence and follow their super simple directions there. Now, on with the show. My guest this week is Jane Boulware. Jane is the author of Worthy, From Cornfields to Corner Office of Microsoft. Her career started from an unlikely beginning in rural Iowa and ascended to chief marketing officer at Kimberly-Clark, later becoming a top executive at multiple roles in none other than Microsoft. She's currently chairman of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Bellevue, Washington, and FYI, all proceeds of her book, Unworthy, which is incredibly worthy, I highly recommend it, all of her proceeds go to support the Boys and Girls Clubs of Bellevue, Washington. She's currently also the chief marketing and chief strategy officer of the Gottman Institute, whose mission is to help people cultivate and maintain love and health in their marriage and relationships. Jane, thank you so much for joining me today.
I have been so looking forward to talking to you, Dr. Laura. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, I just gave all sorts of information. I'm going to have you do your 30-second elevator pitch in just a second. I got to gush for just a minute because I have to tell you how much I loved the book. It was so personal. It was so raw at certain points. It was utterly relatable from beginning to end. It made me laugh out loud multiple times. And I found myself rooting for you, getting mad for you, and just really highlighting like every other page, some sort of quote. And I'm going to have you read a couple of excerpts here and there as sort of intros to some of the topics that I want to address. But I probably would have just spent less time if I'd highlighted the stuff I didn't want to talk about here. It would have been less highlighting in the book. So with all of that, first, give us your 30-second elevator pitch, and then we'll talk a little bit more about your book.
Wow. Thank you for that. I guess my 30-second elevator pitch is I am the author of the book Worthy, From Cornfields to Corner Office. And it literally is a collection of 50 stories from growing up in rural Iowa all the way to the corner office. And it is not a how-to book. It is not a be-like-me book. It is a collection of stories that turned myself inside out to share with you the feelings. And actually, the book is called Unworthy. It's about undoing the uns because I was often told what I can't, won't, and shouldn't do and listen to the voices that tried to hold me back. And I realized oftentimes those voices were my own. Mm. And so my hope in writing this book is that it's something that's relatable and resonates with all so that people will overcome their voices and will claim their worth and maybe be inspired to do what they thought they might not be able to do.
So let me make sure that I heard a correction. If that is the book actually titled Worthy or Unworthy? Because when you look at the cover, the un is crossed out.
The un is crossed out because in fact, the book and the stories are about undoing your uns. But I figured if I called it Unworthy, people wouldn't probably want to buy it. So we actually referred to it as Worthy because at the end of the day, that's what we are.
Okay. So I did say it right.
You said it correctly. Yes.
Good. It's amazing. Why did you write the book?
I wrote the book just for the reasons I said. I have been exposed to many programs and initiatives and books that talk about how to be successful, the how-to books, or are autobiographies about someone that was successful and it seems unachievable or it seems like I could never be that. And oftentimes when I was mentoring people would say to me, what's your secret sauce? If only I could, if only I was like you. And their expectation is that I had something they didn't. Or they looked at me and said, you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. Or, you know, I can't be like that. There's no secret sauce.
Yeah.
I wrote down my stories so that they would realize that everybody has fears. Anybody can overcome their fears. Anyone can overcome their circumstances, their limitations, to become whatever their definition of success is. And that worthy isn't something that you get through a title or a paycheck or anything like that. It's something that we're all born with. And recognizing that and leading with that and knowing that is really important. So I wrote the stories. Actually, I didn't intend to write a book. As you know, I wrote down my stories in promise to other people and was encouraged to write the book and to publish the book by Dr. John Gottman. And that's also in the book, how that came to be. And I'm very glad that I did.
And so am I. That's what brought us here today. And I'm super excited about it. And I want you to share some of the excerpts from that. One of the themes throughout is the need or the feeling of the need or both of needing to prove yourself, to prove that you belonged, that whole imposter syndrome, the whole, I'm not from where all of you are from. How do I convince you that I belong here, that you should listen to me, that you should respect me, that I have something of value to contribute? And one of the components that comes along with that is the challenge of balancing adaptability and how to connect with them, whoever the them is, with authenticity, how to be you. And you refer to yourself frequently as, I'm a pig farmer from Iowa.
I'm a pig farmer from Iowa.
Yep, cornfields. That's in the subtitle of the book. That's not exactly C-suite context.
No.
You know, part of why I never went to teach in universities in the rural areas is because I always said I love cows and pigs and corn, but on my plate, not in my backyard. That's not my cultural comfort zone for a living. So I imagine it would be equally challenging to go in the opposite direction. Now, on page 87, you share a revelation with a really massive leadership communications lesson. Would you share that excerpt with us, please?
I realized that the way I thought and acted and talked sometimes was different. And I realized that I was the outlier. I was the one that needed to translate my thoughts to communicate in a way that linear thinkers could understand and embrace. To get heard, I realized I had to express myself logically in ways that others could hear. Not just the way I spoke, but the way others could hear. Because linear thinkers tolerate passion, but demand facts. So I needed to figure out, how did I give my freewheeling mind room to connect the dots in a non-conventional way to come up with new approaches and then deconstruct the big ideas so that I could logically sell it to others. I realized at that time that one of the strengths that I brought, even though I didn't have the pedigree sometimes, I certainly didn't come from multi-generational money, which there's nothing wrong with that, but what that meant is I had never even seen the ocean until I was 25. I didn't have many of the experiences that others called upon. But because my experiences enabled me to see things a little differently, I was able to approach something differently, translate it into a way that it can be heard.
Yes.
Sometimes it doesn't matter if you're right, if the person that's receiving it doesn't buy in, doesn't grok it, can't hear it.
Yes.
And that's what became a key skill for me, is translating, actually distilling complexity into something that could be absorbed at all levels, executive as well as junior levels.
So how do you do that while still being you? Because one of the complaints that I hear so often, especially from women and certain minority groups, et cetera, is that feeling, the fear of having to give up who you are to talk like a man, to act white, to do whatever, and that fear of being inauthentic.
Yeah.
And also the feeling of, why isn't there some give and take? Like, isn't it up to them to be more inclusive of how they are listening and to make it a more, you know, with the multicultural workspaces that we have nowadays, how much responsibility is theirs versus yours in this two-way communication?
It's a great question. I think, honestly, it's in everybody's best interest to come together to seek to understand. But that realistically isn't always the case. And I can tell you from experience, trying to adapt myself to put myself a round peg in a square hole didn't work very well for me. When I went to Microsoft, I didn't know technology. I didn't dress, act, et cetera, the way they did. And I wanted so desperately to fit in that I carved off the parts of myself that were most important. In many cases, the things that got me to the corner office or made me the leader that was successful. And it was only after I failed at that so badly that I looked at myself and asked myself the question, really, who do I want to be? How do I want to come across? Because that's authentic to me. And if it doesn't fit in this space, then maybe the space isn't right for me. But it's also, you talked about adaptability. It is a technology company. And I needed to do my part to learn enough and adapt enough that my voice could be heard. So my voice was meaningful. So my voice was relevant. That's my responsibility. And yes, they need to come to the table and be able to hear that, but I need to be able to translate. When I speak to an audience, I do not like to go from a script. I like the outline to be there, and I don't sometimes like it scripted. But for me to be successful, I like to speak to people before I walk on stage to find out what's on their mind, maybe get to know somebody and speak to that person, because that's the way of connecting the audience and my speech. And I speak in a way of what I heard and adapt it accordingly.
Am I inferring correctly, or would it be fair to say that to the extent that in the moment communication, you need to get a message across, It's up to us as speaker to modify it, the message, in a way that they're going to be able to receive it, where it's up to quote unquote them, whoever the collective them is, to learn to listen differently. Is that more of a cultural sea change? That's more of an over time expectation. Whereas, yes, theoretically, someone else should be expected to listen differently, but I can't make them listen differently in the moment.
I think it's a communication maturity. The reality is when you talk to your children, you talk differently than when you talk to executives, is when you talk to your spouse or you talk to your elderly parents. You adapt your speech and what you say, how you say it, in such a way that they can hear it.
Yes.
And to not do that because you think they should be something they're not may be legitimate, but it's not effective.
And I think that's a beautiful way to put it. Having those expectations, like in any relationship, you can want someone to be different, but you can't expect them to be somebody that they're not. You can hope for change and some change will happen, but we all know change occurs slowly at best.
There's no magic wand. If there was, I would have wielded it more often.
Oh, I tell clients all the time, it's a pen, not a wand in my hand. If I had a wand, I'd charge a whole lot more. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Now, we talk also in the book about the differences between leadership and management. And, you know, when we first talked a couple of weeks ago, you said something to me you didn't reference it in your book, but it stuck out in my mind. You said most managers are not leaders, and that this was a lesson that you learned when you were a teenager in the cornfields of Iowa. And that back then you probably wouldn't have used words like leader and manager. But what was your realization back then? And how does it translate to leadership in corporate America today?
I have a story in the book that talks about detasseling corn when I was a teenager. And it's grueling hard work. You spend 10 hours in a cornfield. First you freeze and then you get scorching hot. And so I led a team of teenagers, fellow teenagers, into this cornfield every morning at 5:30 in the morning. And we worked in the hot sun until it was time to leave. And what I learned from that is there's a big difference between managing and leading. Managing means they knew where to go, when to show up, and what was expected of them. That was managing. Leading was getting them to do it. Leading was inspiring them to work as a team and setting the example and knowing how to motivate. And I'll tell you what, laughter works a lot better than fear. Creating that environment where people actually, I couldn't make the work easier, but I could make working together easier.
Yes.
So that's really where I learned the difference between the two, and to figure out what motivates individuals, because you can't motivate a group. You motivate individuals, and what might work for one person is different for another.
Yes.
But you know, we would go up and down those rows, and inevitably some people were fast and some people were slow. And as a fast person, the first thing I would do is go back in and go after the folks that were a little bit behind. And sure enough, people would follow my lead until at the end of the day, it just became not because they were slow, it just became what you did.
Yeah.
And nobody celebrated until everybody was done. So the difference again, I say a lot of managers are very good at saying, here's the objectives, here's what has to be done, here's the reports we need to provide. And they're very schedule and deadline and probably meeting driven. Mm-hmm. The leader finds a way to have people understand why it's important. What's the excitement in doing it? How do we feel about making sure we're doing it together?
Yeah, again, I'm going to encourage everybody to buy the book, read the book, proceeds go to the Boys and Girls Club. But the story that was in there that you're talking about, the piece that Jane left out in that is that a lot of the key teams who are friends in that group wanted to quit. And who could blame them?
They wanted to quit. Yeah. In fact, we threatened to quit. They didn't need the money like I did. The truth was they were there to get extra spending money.
Yeah.
And I was there to pay for my bills and to have a chance of going to college.
Yeah.
I needed them. They did not need the job and they didn't need me.
That's so key.
Until I asked them and shared with them why this was important to me and what doing the job and getting the bonus meant to me and what it meant if I didn't get it. And once they understood the higher purpose, they showed up early.
Yeah.
And it was a different feel. When we came together, it was a very different feel. We were rallied together around a goal that was bigger than pulling tassels out of corn.
Yes.
It was really creating an opportunity for getting out of the cornfields.
Which is so beautiful. And that's the key, finding that internal collective purpose that comes from the heart. And I think that's an important leadership ability, that intuition, that knowing how to talk to somebody's heart and not just to their brain. Now, on the other end, when we look at the brain part, a lot of people also get frustrated when they feel like they're being dismissed. Mm-hmm. And you reference in a couple different places, things like, you know, initially you tried getting heard by talking louder, but in the end that just made you come across as obnoxious and more easily dismissed, ironically. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, later on page 91, you talk about when you first applied for the job at Kimberly-Clark, which is right after you graduated with your MBA. Can you share that little excerpt in there? Because I love the way you phrase this.
For the background, someone came to recruit at Purdue University where I had gotten my MBA, and he came to recruit for engineers, not MBAs. So I went to the engineering recruiting evening and told Dave that I wanted a job in marketing at Kimberly-Clark, and he dismissed me. And this is what I wrote. Dave quickly dismissed me, saying it wasn't possible. Casey didn't hire MBAs from Purdue, and besides, they already had fully hired their marketing class for the coming year. Sorry, he said, there were no openings. Dave didn't yet see what was going to happen.
Can I tell you how much I love that quote? I like bolded it and highlighted it and made notes about it and whatever else. It's like, so you just don't see that I'm going to win. Allow me to make that clearer for you. Love the moxie, the chutzpah, all whatever you want to call it that was behind that. Just the absolute conviction that I'm going to win this battle. And by my winning it, by the way, Dave, you're going to win it as well. So what goes through your head when you realize you're being summarily dismissed? And how do you regroup and win without becoming defensive or combative and likely then, of course, making them defensive and combative in return?
Laura, one of my favorite words is yet. It seems to me that the difference between those who do and those that do not, those who get things done and those that do not, is the word yet. So on paper, I may not be qualified yet.
Yes.
You may look at me and say that I'm not going to achieve something, but I think of it and say, it's just not happened yet. If it weren't for the word yet, I would still be in Iowa and I wouldn't be talking to you today, which I love Iowa, just to be clear.
Sure.
And that's how I keep it different, because I can appreciate that when they look at me, they see maybe what I am or what their perception is. And I see where I've been and I see where I'm going to go. And they just haven't seen it yet. They haven't experienced it yet. So I don't need to be defensive because I know where I've been. They don't. They don't know where I've come from, and they don't know what I've overcome and what I will do and where I will be. I just need to help them get there because they're going to. And it's in our both best interest for that to happen. So that's how I look at it. There's no reason to be defensive. There's no reason for me to be loud or anything else. It's just like, I got to work harder because this is going to happen and they haven't seen it yet. In the case of Dave, I ended up taking him to coffee the next morning and I had a job interview just over the phone within a week. And I was on a plane 2 weeks after that and I had a job offer within a month.
Love it.
We're a position that didn't exist.
Look at that. Isn't that funny? Those positions just somehow magically appeared once you poked far enough.
And you know what? I will say this. People often ask me to meet with them or to be their mentor or any of those things. And I look at my calendar and it's full and I'm like, I don't have any time. But when someone comes to me and says, hey, will you have a cup of coffee with me? Or can I buy you a cup of coffee? Or can I hand you a cup of coffee as we're walking? Everybody drinks. Everybody's got that time. Or if they say, I want your opinion, I don't have time, but they want my advice, that implies I'm vested in them. Mm. So sometimes it's literally how you approach it.
Yes.
But that word yet is the difference in my mind between stepping back and moving forward.
What a great perspective for momentum and for just not giving up, reminding ourselves, don't just take the first no, try again.
It's going to happen and probably on my terms. I mean, when I wrote this book, I didn't intend to write the book. And then I was given the opportunity to go with a publishing house and I realized I'd lose my rights, I'd lose most of the profits and I'd lose control. And they wanted to make it more about a Microsoft tell-all. Mm. And that wasn't why I wrote the book. I wrote the book to enable, encourage, and empower people to overcome the limitations in their lives.
Yeah.
Not to be a tell-all about Microsoft.
Right.
So I said no, and people thought I was crazy. But I did it anyway. And I'm so grateful for you for having me on your show. When I'm not a celebrity, I don't have a powerhouse behind me. What I have are some really great stories people can relate to and resonate with people. And I'm hoping that will get some money for the Boys and Girls Club.
Well, I think it's a celebrity and you're certainly making a massive impact on everybody who's listening today. And if I haven't gushed enough, it should be pretty clear that you've made a big impact on me, which is why I want to share that with everybody else. So we're going to continue our conversation as long as you're willing to keep talking to me. So, all right.
I'm open. I love this.
So we've gone from Dave, and now I want to go from Dave to Kent and the Kents, so to speak. And there's a nice little line that you mentioned that the Kents are dangerous. The Kents are not about outdoing and outperforming people. They're about undoing people. So yeah. In case people out there haven't figured it out, Kent has become the archetype of people who undermine you, backstab you. They're either aggressive or passive aggressive, playing games, sabotaging, et cetera, to make themselves look and feel superior. And then sadly, the only way they know how to feel good about themselves is to make you look and sound and feel worse. So it's a very zero sum kind of mentality, which is sad. But what advice do you have for someone who has a Kent on their team or, God forbid, as their boss?
Well, if you are the manager and you have a Kent on your team, and that's an attitude problem, I have found it to be very difficult to manage for attitude because those folks don't typically change. If they're putting down women or minorities or putting down everyone, and that is a cancer, frankly, that I cut deep and wide and I remove. If it's a manager, that's more difficult, obviously. And you've got to be able to, I mean, assuming that you want to maintain the job, assuming you have to navigate.
Meaning if it's like your manager, someone that you report up to.
Your manager. And you can't move around. I mean, you have to decide if you're not able to leave. Because again, I find those people to be very soul-sucking. And most likely great work is going to be taken and reflected as theirs and not yours. So building a community of people around you that can support you. Building a community of people around you who recognize the work that you're doing so that you aren't reliant solely upon that individual is helpful. And then also just being really thoughtful about being clear what you're good at, documenting what you're good at, because in case they are tearing you down or doing something that's not appropriate, you have that capability. I wish I had the magic bullet for Kents. I worked for a number of Kents, sometimes more successfully than others. I will tell you this, a lion's roar comes from fear. And so when you've got a manager or someone that is a Kent that is trying to push you down so he can lift you up, it's a fear-based thing. So doing what you can to address that, I mean, you can't necessarily change it, but doing what you can to know where that's coming from and to reduce that barrier is also helpful. They're poison.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, one of the hardest things about having a Kent on your team is making the decision about whether and how to just get rid of them because they're unlikely.
It's not a decision. It's not hard.
Okay.
I am that ruthless. I have three things that I hire for. One is ability. Are they able to do the job?
Sure.
The other one is, you know, aptitude. Are they a square peg in a round hole? If they are, then you can train them all you want, but they probably are better off in another job and help them find it so that they can be successful.
Sure.
If it's ability and they need training. Give them what they need to be successful. Remove their barriers to success. If the barrier is attitude, they are coming with a bad attitude. They do not become a person of one. They start to infiltrate the others within the organization with bad attitude. And in that scenario, it is not difficult for me to make the decision on where on my team they exist because they don't.
So that's something I would assume is going to be a much deeper HR issue for certain people if firing.
You have to document, you have to be performance driven. It's got to be all those things. Typically a bad attitude. I'm assuming that's leading to poor performance. It's leading to issues and how they're treating others on the team, which is why I'm so clear about it. I will not tolerate people on my team to be treated poorly.
Yeah. It's a standard that they set. What you accept from one, you have to accept from all. And that's, that makes a really big difference, doesn't it? Now, speaking of fears, one of the other topics that you reference is the difference between feeling afraid and being good enough. And that is something I think we all struggle with at different points. On page 45, you've got a great little summary quote there. Can you give us that, please?
There is a big difference between feeling afraid and being good enough. I felt afraid, but I was capable. After all, I had created the presentation, knew the material better than any. I was good enough. I knew it. I could be afraid and capable and good enough.
So what is the difference between feeling afraid and being good enough? And how do we both distinguish the experience and reconcile it when the time comes?
That's a great question. The difference between being afraid and feeling good enough.
I guess the difference isn't probably the right word, but the reconciliation, recognizing that when we have to identify the difference and allow both.
Yeah. I'm going to take a step back a little in my answer.
Sure.
I used to be afraid of being afraid. I thought that if I was afraid, I was a fake because I should have the answers. I shouldn't be afraid. I didn't want people to see that I was afraid. So I tried to act fearless. Mm. And when I acted fearless, I felt like a fraud, hence imposter syndrome. Mm. Laura, I've come to accept and even embrace. I'm no longer afraid to be afraid because now I think of being afraid as being outside my comfort zone, stretching, growing, doing something I'm uncomfortable with that I haven't done before. And that's actually good. It's not bad to be afraid. So yes, I can be capable and be afraid because I'm growing and stretching and I'm getting better and better. So I'm putting myself out there. And in doing that, I'm nervous, I'm afraid, but I'm still capable. I can still do it. When I go on stage and I talk to people, I'm going to be afraid because I want to do well. That's okay. And I'm capable of doing well. I'm capable of speaking, acting, expressing myself. I might be nervous and I might be afraid, but I'm still capable.
Yes, that's the difference. I think people misconflate the concepts of being fearless mm-hmm. with being courageous. Mm-hmm. And they're absolutely not synonymous. That fearless is having no fear. Courageous is feeling the fear and doing it anyway.
Yes.
And that's what we strive for, yes. if I'm not mistaken.
Fearless? Really? I mean, is anyone ever fearless? Shoot, I'm afraid for my kids. I'm afraid for lots of things. Some in my control, some not in my control. That's the human condition. That's okay.
Thank you for saying that it's okay, because I feel like there's a lot of people who keep telling themselves that they're not supposed to, or that they let the fear stop them. And sometimes we just need permission from somebody else mm-hmm. to say, it's okay, and to have your inner whatever mental block go, right. Thank you for reminding me of that explicitly. I needed that reset.
The other thing, it's okay not to know. It's okay to say, I don't know this. There are three words the ego cannot say. I don't know. I am sorry. But when you say those three words, those magic words, things open up.
Yes.
Because you express that you're human and you need help. You need support. You made a mistake.
Yes.
It's okay. Especially as a leader. Especially as a leader, you have to be able to say, I don't know. I made a mistake. I am sorry.
There's the right kind of humility. It's not a self-effacing humility, but recognizing and owning and modeling that. Because if you can't own your own mistakes, if you can't own those kinds of things, why would anybody else mm-hmm. on the team? If it seems like that's a behavior that's required to get to the top. Back to that whole modeling and setting a cultural standard and expectation.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of saying, I don't know, that brings me to another topic that I wanted to bring up, which is that challenge of when you don't have the technical expertise, but you're supposed to lead. And you mentioned this earlier that you went from Kimberly Clark, which was more of a consumer product goods space, to Microsoft, which is tech. And that's not where you were from. So
I was not fluent in tech. I didn't know tech. I didn't know any of that. Yes.
So on page 229, you have a great little quote about that and what you came to realize knowing that you didn't have the tech mm-hmm. and wrestling with that imposter syndrome in the beginning. What did you realize?
I was surrounded by people who were techie.
Of course.
There's no way I could have out-teched the tech. And I came in as their leader. I went to howitworks.com to look up operating system before I managed the Windows business. Mm. This is what I realized shortly. And here's what the quote is. What the team needed of me wasn't IQ, technical expertise, or marketing prowess. They needed courage. It wasn't enough for me to stand up. They needed me to stand up for them.
Yes.
They needed someone to take the arrows, not the accolades.
So how did you realize this and what did you do about it?
What I realized is this was a team that had been getting the arrows and not the accolades. And they had many of the answers. They had the expertise. They were very, very good, but were not well regarded because they'd never had anybody stand up for them. And I realized that I was never going to win the race of out-teching them. But what I knew I was good at is finding out what their strengths were and aligning their strengths around what we needed to achieve, getting them what they needed to succeed, and then removing the barriers to their success. In other words, they didn't need a doer or a manager. They needed a leader who could rally them, identify what made them really great, and then make them better than they thought they could or would be. And that's what I sought to do. I did not compete with them. I saw what they had that I didn't and brought it together and elevated it. I couldn't compete with them,
yeah.
But they had what I didn't. And when we put all of us together, we kicked butt. We were unbelievable. We really were. I'm so proud of that team. They're still friends today. It's been 20 years and we're still good friends.
Oh, that's awesome. That's amazing. It's that perfect chocolate and peanut butter combination.
It was.
Definitely not the same, but perfect complementarity.
And I do think a lot of people, when they join a team, they try to become the best at things instead of recognizing the best in others.
Yes.
Wow, it took a lot of pressure off of me to recognize I couldn't compete with them, but instead could help make them better than they thought they could or would be. That became my goal.
Now, one of the other very extremely human challenges that you referenced was that you tend to be, and I think everybody out there should be nodding their heads in agreement on this, but that you can be slow to recognize, much less celebrate your own successes and your own achievements, and instead tend to come out always looking for what else could be better, that whatever's not enough, recognizing the pitfalls instead. And it's what Dan Sullivan refers to as living in the gap rather than the gain, if anybody has read any of his books. Can you read the little quote that you've got about that one?
These are so tricky for me. You've picked these out. I'm happy to clap and cheer at other successes, but slow to recognize my own. Probably because I'm never satisfied with my performance, focusing on what I'm not versus what I am, constantly seeing the ways I can improve, to be better, to do betterer, which I suppose makes me a competitive person. Competition motivates me to be a better version of myself, to be betterer.
I love the way that you say that, to be betterer. Why is this so hard? Why is it important to make the shift, and how do you do it?
That's a great question. I think it's even specific to women that we're just so hard on ourselves because we expect so much of ourselves. We compare our insides to someone else's outsides way too often. Mm. And then we use a yardstick by which we can never measure up, so that when we achieve something, we see what has yet to happen or what has yet to be achieved. Instead of taking that step back and going, wow, look what I or what we did. This is great. And the challenge with not recognizing it in yourself is that you're not setting a great example for your team. Mm-hmm. You're not setting a great example for your kids or your family. I really think it's important to do both, to recognize the success and to humbly recognize it and to seek to be betterer, to continue to advance and be the best you can and do the best with what you got.
So just in the last couple of minutes that we've got here, I want to change directions just a little bit at the end here. I want to talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse without sounding biblical.
Gottmans.
Yes, exactly. In one of your current roles, you're serving as the chief marketing officer for the Gottman Institute, which is the foremost leaders in what makes marriage and intimate relationships work.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, based on the lifetime body of work of Drs. John and Julie Gottman, who you also credit for saving your own marriage. And they've done great things for mine as well. Love their resources.
Yep.
And you referenced that they identify what they call the four horsemen, the four behavioral predictors of divorce or breakups in relationships are criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. And it seems like those are extremely relevant for work relationships and corporate culture as well, not just for intimate personal relationships. So how did you concretely apply what you learned from the Gottmans about these four horsemen to your work at Microsoft and in other leadership roles?
Oh my gosh. Come to understand the Gottmans' work on relationships, not just marriages, but relationships. They're 100% applicable. And so many things are applicable. Things like 5-1, 5 positive to every negative. So if you have a conversation with a direct report or anybody and you say, oh, you did this and this really well, but you could have done this better. It's got to be a ratio of at least 5-1 or they take away only the negative. The concept of a soft startup, which says if you've got something that you want to communicate and maybe it's difficult, you can't just come in and hit them like a brick wall. They won't hear you. So if you have a soft startup, again, maybe starting with something positive, and that's not to say don't be direct, but there's that. And then, you know, there's just so, so many things. You know, Laura, I've attended hundreds probably of seminars and programs, et cetera, on communication and sales and marketing and leadership, et cetera. And I've never once attended one that talked about the most important relationship in my life, which is my marriage, my family. And yet when I go into the workplace, if I'm not in a good place in my personal life, I carry that into my professional life. And if I learn in my personal and professional lives how to manage a relationship, both do better. So that's why I've invested, you know, my time in the Gottman Institute, because I believe in relationships. I believe that we all want to have good relationships and simply aren't aware of some of the tools that sabotage us.
And the fact, I think people aren't also aware of the fact that there are tools to help us. So, which is why I wanted to bring them up and wanted to give you the opportunity to reference some of those valuable lessons and let people know that the Gottman Institute is available for everybody. And of course, those same four horsemen are relevant in our relationships with our parents, with our siblings, with any kind of relationship.
Absolutely.
So thank you for that.
And I'm supposed to be pitching my book, but I would say The Prescription by John and Julie Gottman came out recently. It's very good.
Oh, great. We'll put that resource in the show notes as well.
The quick read.
Oh, good. Okay, even better. What we can get through quickly is always...
And buy it when you're buying Worthy.
Yes.
So there you go.
There you go. It's a 2-for-1 value on this podcast. Two great resources for your personal and professional lives. And lastly, Jane, time for the 24-hour influence challenge. Normally this is in the middle, but I want to wrap it up and just send people off with a bang. This is your chance to challenge our listeners to take one step that they can complete within 24 hours to have more influence. How would you like to challenge our listeners today, aside from, of course, buy Worthy? I'll give you that one.
Uh-huh. I would say to stop being afraid and being so hard on yourself and take a chance and say to yourself, if you don't know how to do something, you haven't done something, it's just that you haven't done it yet, because you are worthy just as you are, and you need to claim that worth and be inspired to rethink what's possible in your life.
Beautiful.
Overcome those people that say otherwise. You can do it.
Stick that word yet on the end of whatever they say.
Yet.
No matter what the no sounds like, just go yet. Maybe don't say it out loud necessarily to their faces. They may not appreciate that, but you'll win. Mm-hmm. I love it. Please, Jane, tell us more about your book, where to find it, and how to connect with you.
Well, the book is called Worthy, From the Cornfields to the Corner Office. You can buy it in any place that books are sold, or on Audible or iTunes, etc. And you can reach me at janebulwer.com. All my proceeds are being donated to the Boys and Girls Club. If you have a speaking opportunity, please invite me. Again, all proceeds I'm donating to the Boys and Girls Club. So you get to advance not only yourself and being able to read the book, but also some child or some person that may not have that opportunity otherwise.
Jane, thank you so much. I have loved every minute of this conversation. I'm so sorry to see it come to an end. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Laura. It's been so great. Thank you.
And to everybody out there listening, thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you have not done so yet, be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And if you love the show, please give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your platform of choice, so we can continue to help even more people increase their confidence, presence, and influence. If you're not sure how to do that, you can also go to the website ratethispodcast.com/influence and follow their instructions there. And of course, if you want to download my free guide to equipment recommendations for virtual influence, including my picks for microphones, lights, and more, go to speakingtoinfluence.com. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, and you're listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite.
Thanks for listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite, the show for leaders who want to speak with impact. The hosts, producers, owners, and media distributors of the show make no guarantees that the strategies and information discussed will result in profit or other success and may result in losses. The opinions and statements of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the owners, staff, managers, broadcasters, or sponsors of the show. No medical or psychological therapy or personal or professional wellness or relationship advice is offered in the show. You are advised to seek counsel on matters related to your health, family, relationships, job, or other business and legal matters from licensed advisors in those areas prior to making any changes in business or lifestyle. No information provided may be suitable in your situation. As always, take responsibility for the decisions and actions you take, including the reactions they may make in your work, family, health, and life.